This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Purple People Bridge is looking less purple these days, and that has its ownership feeling blue. An expensive paint job and facelift are needed, and the Newport South Bank Bridge Company is turning to the public for help. Coming up, a chat about the span's future and more about the riverfront development in northern Kentucky. But first, there are a lot of new developments in the urban core, from downtown Cincinnati to over the Rhine to the river cities of northern Kentucky. New housing and new businesses are emerging in previously challenged areas. But what about the people who were there all along? Is there a better way for the region to approach fair housing and equitable development? Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss are Director of Development and Operations at the Greater Cincinnati Homeless Coalition, Mona Jenkins. Welcome, Mona.
Thank you.
Community Education and Volunteer Coordinator at the Peasley Neighborhood Center, Jen Ahrens. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you.
And Committee Chair of the Planning and Development Committee for the Walnut Hills Area Council, Katie Dietz. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks.
If you want to join our conversation, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org. We'll look for your comments on Facebook or your tweets on Twitter as well. You know where to find us there. Katie, your part of Cincinnati is seeing a lot of new development. Walnut Hills appears to be on the rise. So tell us what fair housing and development equity mean to you in that context.
Yeah. So for us, I think what it means is giving voice to everybody in the development. And so not making it about one particular kind of development, but creating a community that can hold all socioeconomic and racial backgrounds.
So are you seeing in the development that's taking place over there these considerations, or is it something that you're trying to talk about?
It's more what we're trying to talk about and get the conversation going. In the past, not everyone's been invited to the table to have the conversation. And so that's what our goal is can everyone come to the table?
How is it progressing?
It's been good at starting to get the conversations going. We've had so much turnout at our area council meetings in which people want to know about what's going on and how they can have input.
And Mona, you represent an organization that assists the homeless. How has the region fared in regards to supporting or assisting the homeless population amid all the new development?
So we're still suffering from a shortage overall of affordable housing. And with new development that's happening in neighborhoods, we're going to see an increase in that shortage. And so especially with me being a resident of Walnut Hills, I wanted to see that folks were included in the conversations. And that includes current residents, but also taking consideration because people who are experiencing homelessness are residents of the neighborhoods as well, including that voice in the conversation too.
Are you seeing that people are being priced out of their areas?
Definitely. That's what happened to me. I'm no longer in Walnut Hills as of 6 months ago because I got priced out. My entire apartment building was turned into a condo 2 years ago. We weren't even notified. We found out from a news article. And as a result, what I found out from a resident who I happened to run into in the neighborhood who showed me the article and said, "Isn't this your apartment?" And I said, "Yes." And I immediately started knocking on my neighbor's doors and calling them and asking if they knew anything about it. And they had no notice whatsoever. And so that's part of the reason why I started getting – I was already active in Walnut Hills as a resident, but became more active was because I realized that while our building was one of the first publicly known start of development and changes happening in the neighborhood, I knew a lot of our residents in Walnut Hills were going to be affected and wanted to start a conversation of how do we include folks into and improving the relationship between the developers that are coming in with the residents.
So you lost your home to redevelopment.
Yes.
Was that true for the rest of the tenants in that building as well?
Most of the residents, most of us had a 45-day notice. So after the article came out, we contacted the landlord developer. They said, "We'll send you a letter in about a week." It took about 2 weeks. Because most of our leases were up, mine was the only one that actually still had another year. Everyone had to be out within 45 days. So even though I still had another year, none of us could find places that were affordable for us. And we're talking about, I mean, I work full-time at the Homeless Coalition. Someone else was a full-time manager at a bank. Someone else was a manager at a hotel. And as a result, you know, we're assuming that affordable means subsidized. And it's not. It's based on a third of your income.
That's a point I want to address a little later on, is what exactly it means and people's misconceptions about it as well. But one more follow-up to that is you had a developer change the context of your building from a rental building to condominium where people were purchasing homes.
Correct.
You'd lived in Walnut Hills. You could not find another apartment in that neighborhood at a price that you could afford.
Correct.
So what was triggering the increase in the prices in the apartment community there, do you believe?
New developments coming in. The anticipation of the changeovers in the business district and what would be anticipated 18 to 24 months later was already being present in the rates of the rents right then and there.
So some statistics. The average rent for the entire city proper of Cincinnati is about $972. The average rental price per month in Over the Rhine or Pendleton is $1,600. Are you seeing similar numbers like that in Walnut Hills now that's pricing people out, Mona?
Yes, it's starting to increase. So if you're looking at a one bedroom and it's starting at $1,100 to $1,200, that's a little high.
Jen, you and the Peasley Neighborhood Center created something called the Equitable Development Rubric. I imagine this was to address some of these types of concerns. Before we dive into what the rubric is, tell us what the Peasley Neighborhood Center is.
Yeah, so Peasley is a community center in Over the Rhine downtown that's been there existing as a community center for about 34 years. It's a place that runs programs that are based in education and enrichment, primarily for residents with low incomes in our urban core, and with all our programs aimed at social change work.
So the rubric you created serves as a sort of evaluation tool to make sure that Cincinnati is a fair and equitable place to live. That's language from the rubric itself. How does it go about doing that? There's this complicated grading scale.
Sure, sure. So yeah, at its core is the actual rubric or a scorecard, and it generates a score for a particular development project based on its contributions to equity across class and race in the city, particularly around economic opportunity. So it has four main categories around housing affordability, jobs and labor, community input, and something we call community footprint, which is really kind of an anti-displacement element, and then has a number of kind of extra credit categories, too, around environmental standards and community nonprofits, community-serving nonprofits and things like that. So basically, a developer can present a project and can say, hey, I can meet this, that, or the other standard, and that generates an overall equity score for that project.
So what type of authority does the rubric have? Is it just something that people should consider based on your analysis, or is this something that you would encourage governments to adopt?
I would certainly encourage governments to adopt it. I mean, we made it in mind with Cincinnati. With Cincinnati in mind and floating it as a potential policy. But right now we're really working it. Our strategy is really a grassroots strategy. You know, so often these public-private partnerships, the equitable development rubric is specifically attached to incentives in Cincinnati. So it's not a mandate for all development. It's looking specifically at where the city is offering taxpayer assets to invest financially in projects. And we're saying, you know, we have an enormous, enormous equity problem in Cincinnati. It is well documented. And anytime we take on a public initiative or we're investing in private projects, they should be projects that advance equity first and foremost. So in terms of the authority right now, we're putting it in the hands of people and communities and saying, what are these assets? How are they valuable to you? These are ours, right? These are our taxpayer-owned assets. Developers are very clear about what their goals are and what their needs are and not sheepish about asking for those or demanding those. And we need to be doing the same thing in communities and saying, you know, what are these things worth to you and what do we need to be prioritizing in the deals that we cut with our taxpayer-owned assets.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join this conversation about fair housing and equitable development in Cincinnati. So some of the areas that this rubric focuses on in creating a four-point scale for each are housing affordability, jobs and labor, community input, and community footprint. Among those, did you rank any in terms of importance or significance? Is there one of those areas that's more important than the others?
So those four we put, we basically place on equal footing within the rubric itself. Once you get, if you can score past a certain threshold on those four, then we incorporate other things, other elements that are very important to diversity, but we didn't want to be able to overshadow those kind of four core pieces, right? I think to do good community development, you not only need the capital from the market, but you also need really good governance, and you need meaningfully engaged communities who can have a say and have leverage within decision-making processes. So those four components are really our attempt to structure those three elements in the kind of development that we're seeing in Cincinnati.
So a lot of these urban neighborhoods on both sides of the river suffered in the latter half of the 20th century with people flying out to the suburbs. Now what you've seen is that the governments are taking control, financial control of a lot of these structures, a lot of these sites, a lot of these old properties. And like you said, Jen, they are then selling them to developers and usually at bargain basement prices, meeting a lot of incentive demands. I want to hear from all of you based on your organizations and the work that you do, starting with Katie. How do you evaluate the way those conversations have gone down between the government and the developers at the possible expense of some members of the community?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that we see within the area council is there's not a precedence to have those conversations. And so that's what bringing the equitable development scorecard in is a way to ask for those conversations. So it's not just between government and developer, but you're actually inviting the community in, because that's the only way that it's going to have a whole picture of quality of life for every socioeconomic background.
And Mona, your thoughts on it?
I think the community is always left out of the conversation. You know, as I mentioned within my own personal case, I found out from a news article when I should have been sitting at the table with the developer and with the community, with the government to be aware so that I could, you know, plan my lifestyle accordingly. And so that was part of the reason why I introduced the Equitable Development Scorecard to Walnut Hills community. The community council was because I said I wanted to put the people first and foremost. So, you know, I think in the past we've done a poor job of it. And I think now is the time that we need to start putting the community first.
And Jen, we're going to dive a little bit more into this rubric that you've created and how it factors into these conversations. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. We will continue our conversation about fair housing and equitable development in Greater Cincinnati just ahead. Plus, a look at the plans to refurbish the iconic Eleno Bridge, better known as the Purple People Bridge. Cincinnati Edition continues after this short break. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our conversation about fair housing and equitable development in Greater Cincinnati. We're joined by Director of Development and Operations at the Greater Cincinnati Homeless Coalition, Mona Jenkins, Community Education and Volunteer Coordinator at the Peasley Neighborhood Center, Jen Ahrens, and Committee Chair of the Planning and Development Committee for the Walnut Hills Area Council, Katie Dietz. Join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. Quick question for all of you. You know, we're having this conversation about how to better incorporate people of lesser means or people of lower incomes into these development conversations. When you look at some of the corners of the Greater Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky region and the urban centers that have seen revitalization, are these communities better off because of that in spite of the displacement that has taken place?
I mean, I would say it depends on how you define community, right? Are the physical spaces better to look at? Sure, they are, right? That's what investment can do. That's what capital can do, or that it does on its own, right? In terms of whether or not our communities are better, fairer, more meaningfully engaging with each other, structured in a way that facilitates increased opportunity, I would say no. And I would say that, you know, what what happens naturally by market in terms of who gets priced out, left out, and worst, intentionally erased or displaced by way of those processes. That's not an acceptable, negative repercussion, right? That is by design. And I think we really have to look critically and be smart about how we structure the way we plan, the way we court development, what we incentivize and what we facilitate coming into our community so that we do a better job. Because it's an urgent need, we need that. And we'd all be better for it.
So let's talk more about the rubric that you've created to help some communities follow some guidelines that you suggest in order to be more equitable and fairer when it comes to these issues. We went through the main areas that you're grading developers on, but you also offer some extra credit.
Sure.
And some of those areas
that... As any good rubric does,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Everybody wants a bonus point. And some of the bonus points you would award are related to diversity and inclusion, public space and infrastructure, natural environment, community organizations and programs, and local enterprise. Are you seeing those types of extras being included in general in local developments?
I think yes. I think some of those come more naturally by the market. Something like environmental standards, right? That's something that if you've got capital to invest in good environmental design in your building, that's something that pays off in the end. So that's one that I think comes a little bit more naturally, but certainly needs to be much more heavily incentivized. And some of the other things, are maybe less easy to come by. You know, we have a section in there for community-serving nonprofits or community organizations. So something like a grocery store, say, would fall into that category, right? If it's going to demonstrate that it meets a really big need in the community, then you should get points for that, right? That's not nothing. That's bringing a needed asset into a community.
And that's a valid point for our Walnut Hills representative, right. Katie, right? We saw
yes.
the Kroger store leave a void when it closed in Walnut Hills. So perhaps when we talk about development and its impact on those residents who may not have access to either more money or more opportunities, we tend to think about housing mostly, but is there an issue of equity and fairness when a neighborhood loses its main food source?
Yes, definitely. I mean, if you think about where is someone going in a walkable distance and what's the quality of goods they're getting, it makes a huge impact. Like, we have many convenience stores and smaller stores, but those are processed foods. You have a lack of fresh meat, fresh fruits and vegetables, but yet we talk about how everyone should be able to have the same quality of life living in our city.
So we're talking about Kroger. I mean, this is a locally grown corporation, a behemoth in the grocery industry. Is there a role for larger, especially locally based corporations to play in this, where maybe profit isn't the key motivator, but building a stronger community is?
I would argue yes. I mean, if you are a corporation based in our city and you value our city, does that not mean certain people groups are valued?
Good question. Let's go to the phones. We've got Peter on the line. Peter, you have a question or comment?
I do. Thank you. The city has, thanks to the efforts of a number of community groups, finally created an affordable housing fund. And as I understand it, has set aside $750,000 to go into that fund. My question is, what number of units, say on an annual basis, would that $750,000 create?
Thanks for the question, Peter. We'll hang up and let the ladies respond. Anybody have any idea on that?
To my knowledge, the great people who are trying to find a revenue source, a more dedicated revenue source to the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, are using $100,000 per unit of affordable. So that is the cost it takes to create an affordable unit. So that's $750,000, although it is a great gesture, is not going to get us very far. We can do that math, I think, together.
Mona, a lot of times when cities or neighborhoods or developers discuss purchasing or developing a site and there are old buildings involved, it's not uncommon on social media for comments to suggest instead of tearing something down or redeveloping it for commercial purposes, that it would better serve the community. That should be housing for the homeless. Now, it's not as simple as one of those comments would be, but what kind of advocacy is there for redeveloping unused sites to house people who are experiencing homelessness?
You know, that's something that we've asked the city. city owns quite a few properties, and why are we not using and investing in those properties to address the affordable housing issue? Some of these buildings are in such a condition that it is cheaper, better, safer to just tear down the building and to rebuild. But what we are seeing in our communities is that some of these buildings actually have some sort of value to the community themselves. So before tearing it down, it might be a good idea to ask the community, is this building actually of value to you? We've seen a couple buildings in Walnut Hills that were torn down that had significant historical value to us that were just demolished.
Another key area in which homelessness impacts public policy is where to locate shelters or where to allow camps to exist. So what are you finding in terms of local government's attitudes in addressing those issues?
So with the Third Street encampment, you know, around that time, the city council and local officials seemed to be aware of the issue and willing to address it. And had called for a citywide group to get together to actually delve into the issue. Here it is, 6-7 months later, we haven't been contacted or included in any conversations that have happened to still address. Yet there are still folks who are sleeping on the streets. Now they're just hiding because they are scared. We have criminalized it. And there are people who are dying because of this extreme cold. So, you know, if the government does not want to take it upon themselves to start these conversations, I think we, the people, and this equitable scorecard is an excellent way for us to start these conversations.
We got a comment from Angela. She wants to know, Jen, how did you develop the rubric? How did the idea first come about?
Yeah, that's a great question. The idea really came out of I would say the long-term experience of folks in Over the Rhine, right? Peasley is based in Over the Rhine, and even though it's an enrichment and educational space, right, we've really been steeped in the activist history there for a long time. So we've seen people over generations fight disinvestment in that neighborhood and ask and demand good investment. And then this kind of deluge of capital that has come with the caveat of removal. So in part, the rubric itself was in part inspired by a more recent kind of campaign and development project that we got involved in on public land in the neighborhood. And we were sort of taken aback by the plan for this public patch of land, right? It's like there's so much that you can't do when private property passes from hand to hand, right? But when we have public land or we have a tax abatement, right, those are things that, again, we should have democratic say. We should have control, a much higher degree of control than we do elsewhere. So in part, we set out to make a checklist that was going to be for community councils, right? We, Over the Rhine, has seen so many development projects come through and through and through. So anyway, we set out to make a checklist of just questions that people should know to ask because there's no information that is meaningfully presented or no way to kind of pick through that. We ended up making something more complicated, but I think much, much more exciting with a lot greater potential.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes left. I know at the top of our interview, I wanted to make sure that we touched on the actual definition of affordable housing and how it relates to Section 8. I want to talk about a project that was proposed in Ludlow, Kentucky. It was shot down by the city council there last year. It was to be this new construction building with apartments, with a large commercial space on street level at the entry to town. There were concerns about parking and design, but the main concern seemed to be about reserving some of those units for low-income housing. It was a priority of the developer to get low-income housing tax credits in order to be able to afford to develop it and make a profit off of it. So there were messages floating around the city that this meant Section 8 housing was coming to the front of the city. So first, define low-income housing for us and demonstrate its difference from Section 8. Any of you?
Well, actually, so low-income housing could be subsidized or non-subsidized. So, and I'm thinking of, you know, Cincinnati Metropolitan Housing Authority, they have properties that are called low-income public housing where they actually own the site. So, for instance, like Millville or Finlater Garden or Winton Terrace are properties that they own, where they figure out affordability based on 30% of their residents' income. Section 8 is where landlords actually own the property and the residents are given a voucher to then go and search for a property within the city of Cincinnati. So they have more of a choice as far as where they want to live.
So this particular project called Ludlow Yards was one where the proponents said, we're not talking about necessarily people who need government assistance. We're talking about new teachers, early entry-level professionals who are making about $35,000 or $40,000 a year. We want to make sure that they can afford, because they're the types of demographic that will patronize the businesses along the main street. But the criticism that even if it were Section 8 housing that were coming to the front of a city, is that something that neighbors should be concerned about, or is it something that people of better means or higher income should welcome to their neighborhood?
I think it's a stereotype we've created around what low-income housing means. Like we said, affordable housing is 30% of your income. So 30% of your income can be on a huge scale, but we've stereotyped low-income housing as something that causes disturbance or issues that we don't want. But I am considered low-income housing. And so I think we need to break those stereotypes.
Okay, one last question before I let you all go, and I may be putting you on the spot, Jen. I don't know if you applied your rubric yet to this particular development, but the FC Cincinnati Stadium is coming to the West End, and it is not without its controversy related to this topic. How would you rate that just offhand?
You know, I haven't actually run it through the rubric, but, you know, a very large project like that, typically you see communities try to put together something like a community benefits agreement, which we did see in the West End. But the point of a community benefits agreement, which is really similar to the rubric, right? The rubric is basically taking standards of what a typical CBA might be and trying to apply them across the board. But, you know, the point of a CBA is that the community has leverage, right? Before your project gets approved, we have this commitment. And that is one, I think, really egregious mistake on the part of our city, was to approve that project before any CBA was negotiated, right? You really undercut the leverage of the community. Never mind that community council voted against that project in the first place. And as a soccer fan, it's disappointing, right?
So thank you, Mona Jenkins, Jen Ahrens, and Katie Dietz for joining us today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.